Hello and welcome to Emotional Intelligence, Understanding, Applying, and Measuring. And that's exactly what the presentation is going to be about. We're going to talk quite a bit about understanding what emotional intelligence is, a little bit on applying it, and a little bit on measuring it. Before we go on to this, let me tell you briefly why I was interested in doing this presentation or kind of putting this information out there. A few reasons. One, children are in sore need of emotional intelligence, and I'll show you some stats and figures and give you some examples later, but in our society, many of the problems that we have are a result of children with lower emotional intelligence. Also, 95%, I think, of all non-structural problems that happen during the summer, non-structural things being structural things include schedule, materials, not enough staff, orientation skills, that kind of thing. 95% of all the non-structural problems, I think, can be traced to a deficiency in one or more of the 15 emotional intelligence domains. I also think that our society is not doing a very good job of instilling emotional intelligence or providing role models. I mean, one only has to look at what was the Academy Award for Best Picture. It was American Beauty. And if you think about this, it was basically, if you saw the movie, example one after another of extremely unemotionally intelligent people. In movies in general and in television, that is the models that we have. It's hard to think of a television series or of a movie that really shows whole, healthy, happy, together people and families. Unfortunately, that tends not to be what sells tickets or commercials these days. But anyway, I digress. So before, without any further ado, let's go on to the actual presentation. Before I get into the goals of the session, the second slide here, let me do a quick little note on what needs to be done to use this presentation audio together well. You need to be able to pause the audio, because at several points, I'm just going to ask you to read and think about some things that are on the slide. So, if you're using a PC computer, you can use Alt-Tab to go back and forth between the program you're using to play the audio and the presentation. Or you can use the taskbar, or if you're using a Macintosh, whatever you use to switch between applications. So again, try and find the pause button now, and be able to switch back and forth so you can pause that. Okay, goals of the session. To understand what emotional intelligence is and why it is so important. To obtain an overview of the emotional intelligence domains. There's 15 domains, and we're going to go over these in quite some detail. And I think this is a really important delineation because you can read all sorts of books. Daniel Goleman's famous 95 book on emotional intelligence, all sorts of other things, and they really don't lay it out very clearly. I haven't seen a very good delineation of emotional intelligence in many of the books that I've read. So I'm taking a piece here, a piece there, and kind of throwing it all together to really give you an overview that you couldn't get from reading almost many of the books. Delineate some parenting and counseling styles that foster or fail to grow emotional intelligence, and to expose you to some general EQ building principles. And lastly, to talk about what some of the measurement options are for assessing emotional intelligence for both adults and children. So before we go on, though, some realities and caveats. Normally, this whole emotional intelligence sort of lecture discussion takes a half a day, but the presentation where I did this was at Tri-State, it was only 1.25 hours. Likewise, this isn't the best format or medium to go through a really long, in-depth training, and this is just an overview. Also, I definitely think it's better to have a fuzzy whole picture than a small, clear piece of it. So if you think of a large jigsaw puzzle, I think it's better that you see kind of the whole picture of what it is, even if that's fuzzy, as opposed to just giving you one little piece of it. So if I just give you that piece, you really won't understand the scope and nature of the topic of emotional intelligence. So many people sort of have a problem with that and argue with it, but I really think it's the best way to go, and that's the way I'm going to address it. The focus is really on understanding instead of application, which is touched on very briefly. Namely, as it says, is how to increase or the application of any of these, such as improved self-esteem or happiness or assertiveness or all any of those things, would easily be a session in and of itself, at a minimum. So trying to sort of say I can give you how to improve the domains of emotional intelligence in a short time span is literally an impossibility. Also, there's a lot of other information. Since you're listening to this, you have the CD. So on the CD, all this other information listed there is contained. Normally I'd ask for your expectations, why are you here, but since this is a really sort of one-sided kind of thing, hopefully I'll be able to address those. If you do have other questions or concerns or things you'd like to discuss, please feel free to contact me through my website, email, and contact information there. Okay, you'll see an outline on slide 5 here. If you like, you can print this out so you can kind of keep an idea of where we are and where we'll be going as we go through the whole thing. So what is emotional intelligence? Well, emotional intelligence is a word that doesn't yet appear in dictionaries. But if you think about it, the word intelligence, or if you investigate it, didn't appear in books really before the 20th century. For example, in 1927, there was a book of psychological definitions, and in there, the word intelligence wasn't in it. It wasn't really until after 1930 that it started to become pervasive. And again, EQ doesn't appear in dictionaries, but I'm sure it will very soon. So what is emotional intelligence? Well, there's some definitions here that you can read, sort of the more kind of concrete or Webster kind of ideas of what EQ is. Again, Webster doesn't have a definition, so these are just some ones that are kind of common and out there. It's basically, as you can read, the emotional, personal, and social sort of survival dimensions. It's non-cognitive aspects, meaning that it isn't sort of the skill or competency that you might think of as like a physical skill, like playing basketball. It's sort of a more mental, emotional one. In fact, in some ways, it can be akin to intelligence, sort of cognitive intelligence. So, which is why EQ, emotional intelligence, is often coined as a term. If you think about it, all these emotional intelligences, which will be clear later on when we talk about them, aren't anything concrete. You know, happiness is not something that's there. It exists in the mind. So in that sense, it kind of is a cognitive component. But it isn't like intelligence in the sense that it isn't so largely genetically determined. It can be learned, and it can be developed in a way that intelligence really can't be to the same degree. Also, intelligence and cognitive intelligence and emotional intelligence are not related. If you were to look at the correlations between the domains of EQ and the domains of IQ, you'd find almost none there. Okay, so moving on, the last little example here on the bottom, Mr. Spock and PBS. EQ is our emotional intelligence, emotional capacities, are an inherent part of absolutely everyone. It's an inseparable part of our lives. Mr. Spock, if you're a Star Trek fan, you know he was this Vulcan who was supposed to have no feelings. Well, if you're a Star Trek fan, you'll know that one thing, the Vulcans used to have quite a lot of feelings, and they sort of tried to breed them out a little bit, so to speak. And you'll also know that many of the more interesting episodes where Mr. Spock was the main character of focus had him showing emotions, even though he was supposed to be unemotional. You'd often have the good doctor telling him, he's like, well, Mr. Spock, you know, that was an irrational decision. And he'd come up with some explanation or so, but it was clear to the audience and to everybody else that really he was using emotion. So even when an author tries to cope about, you know, creating this person who is wholly unemotional, they couldn't do it. Also, PBS did this brain series, and they talked about this brain injury case where this fellow had a part of his brain severed, the part that connects the amygdala, which is the emotional part of the brain, to the neocortex, which is sort of the new gray matter top part of the brain. Turns out that because he had this part of his brain severed, he really wasn't able to function in real life. For example, they'd ask him something simple, like, when do you want to have your next doctor's appointment? and the fellow was not able to make a decision. He'd go and say, well, you know, Tuesday is okay, but then again, Wednesday might be better, but then I'm doing lunch then, and the traffic's bad. Come up with all these reasons, the pros and the cons of all these, and they'd be so similar that he really couldn't make a logical decision on one was better than the other. And he'd sit there for 10 minutes or plus trying to figure this out. An emotional person would have, you know, some sort of reason for picking one or the other for more personal sort of emotional reasons. So this person was crippled because of that. So those are some general explanations. Go on to the next slide 8 here. You'll see a list of the domains of emotional intelligence. So when people talk about emotional intelligence, more often than not, they're talking about these domains, these areas, and this framework. Briefly, you can see, you can read these yourself. Interpersonal is emotional self-awareness, assertiveness, self-regard, self-actualization, and independence. Interpersonal, empathy, interpersonal relationship skills, social responsibility, adaptability, problem-solving, reality testing, flexibility, stress management, stress tolerance, impulse control, and general mood, happiness, and optimism. Now what we're going to do is go over each of these one by one in turn, and I'm going to offer you a definition so you can sort of read what it is, and then I'll offer you some examples so you can have sort of a better, more real-world idea of these emotional intelligence domains. Before we get into all that, though, I do want to mention why emotional intelligence is so important. So from the Goleman and Gottman books, which are listed in at the end of this presentation, EQ predicts higher work performance 3 times better than IQ. The prediction range is between 15 and 45% in terms of performance. That's an enormous amount of variance accounted for from the statistical sort of point of view. IQ often accounts for about 6%, sometimes more, depends on the position, how it's measured, what other things are measured, all sorts of things. But as a general range, that's where it lies. Leadership is largely an emotional intelligence. Also, if you think about people you know, all interaction can really be gauged along a continuum from emotionally toxic to emotionally nourishing. And I'm sure we all know people who fall on either side of that spectrum. And the people we want to hang out with, and the people who more often than not tend to be more successful in a number of ways, tend to be those who are more emotionally nourishing. 2/3 of workers say communication problems are the leading cause preventing them from doing their best work. Communication, in essence, is an interpersonal emotional intelligence. And EQ is one of the best predictors of divorce and marital satisfaction. I really wish I could get into this whole topic in and of itself. Fortunately, I really can't do that here. However, I do hope that you'll look at the EQ handout file, and at the back of that you'll find, I believe, 2 or 3 pages that sort of delineates why emotional intelligence is so absolutely crucial to close relationships. And this works for all sorts of close relationships in a number of ways. Great application of emotional intelligence has a long way to go in saving marriages and making for positive relationships all the way around. I've referenced the books there that are really crucial to that line of work as well. Okay, on to the next slide, 10. Dr. Baran, he's one of probably the 3 or 4 main emotional intelligence researchers. There really haven't been that many, especially if you consider it isn't a very old field and people have been doing this about 20 years. Daniel Goleman isn't a researcher, he was just sort of a journalist who sort of popularized the concept. Okay, EQ scores help predict academic dropout, ability to cope with a severe medical condition, aggression, suicide attempts, and ability to recover from a mental illness. So emotional intelligence helps quite a bit predict all of these outcomes. They also help discriminate, in other words, tell one group apart from another, members of the Young Presidents Association and chronically unemployed, prisoners in a local normative sample, successful and unsuccessful alcohol treatment participants, and therapists and their clients. So you can see, emotional intelligence, to a high degree, has all sorts of beneficial outcomes, in both terms of group membership and people we think of as more successful, and in the ability to cope with all sorts of problems and do well. Okay, so from the Goleman, Gottman, and Pfeiffer work, again, which are referenced in the end, Over the past two decades, children have become more depressed and lonely, impulsive and disobedient, nervous, prone to worry and irritable, and prone to eating disorder. So what are some of the possible causes for all of these things occurring? Well, one, parents have less free time with their children now. I'm sure we've all heard the statistics of the meaningful interaction time parents have with their children ranges anywhere from the neighborhood of 17 minutes to a couple hours a week, depending how you count it. Less relatives in the children's lives these days. Both parents often work, again, they spend less time. And there's more TV watching and computer game playing. The average child today spends 40 hours using media a week, the equivalent of a full-time job, using media, the vast majority of which is television, although the internet is catching up. And again, as I mentioned in the beginning, television and movies tend not to do the best job of providing emotionally intelligent role models. You're hard-pressed to think of any. The last point is that one learns EQ from a social life, which has been decreasing. Again, media is a prime culprit here, but not the only one for sure. It's important to note this. One learns EQ from a social life. When you think about it, that's what camp is. Camp is a social life. What we do there at camp is spend almost every waking moment in social interaction. The only time I can think of where there really isn't any social interaction is when maybe once if you have kind of a quiet rest hour, although that's kind of a borderline example, or two, when either yourself or a child is in the bathroom. Even then, it might be, you know, social interaction, you know, it's come on, hurry up, get out of there. So camp is a great place to develop emotional intelligence. Okay, now let's go through each of these larger domains and the subcomponents one by one. So the way to do this is I'm going to give you a chance to sort of read the slide, and then I'm going to go over some examples of it. So the best way to do this is I'll pause for a moment, go ahead and hit pause, and when you're ready to continue, hit play again. Okay, emotional self-awareness. This is a really key, they're all key, but this is an important one. Let me give you an example with an adult. 23 seconds, an important research finding. Happens over and over again. Basically, what 23 seconds is they figure that's the average point in which an interaction can turn from bad to worse. Whether you can even salvage it and say, okay, wait, just take a minute. Let's stop, let's think about what we're doing. Or before when it's, you know, just slides down that hill and kind of falls off almost the point of no return. And the argument envelops and everyone gets really upset, the emotions stir, you know, people perhaps even start yelling, they walk away, they get angry, all sorts of things happen. It gets much, much harder to salvage a conflict once it reaches past 23 seconds. In order to sort of short-circuit that whole process, it's important to be very emotionally self-aware. You have to be able to label your own emotions. Are you angry, frustrated, embarrassed, hurt? And you have to be able to think why. Why am I feeling this way? What is your role? And empathy, which we'll talk about more in a minute, is also important. What are they feeling? What is their role? Why are they feeling that way? And problem solving, which we'll get into again in a minute. You have to figure out then, if this sort of thing, you know, how can you sort of go about trying to fix the situation? And having stress tolerance if the situation or the argument tends to be very stressful, if it got that far. Another example of emotional self-awareness is the ability to sort of seek feedback. You want others' perceptions of yourself. So people who are very emotionally self-aware tend to not take their own word for it that they are, you know, great or that they are horrible or that they're God's gift to society. They want other people's opinion and they'll seek it out. They'll ask people. They're like, so, you know, give me some feedback. You know, you were there. What did you think of this? Or they'll fill out perhaps personality measures to get sort of a more objective measure of themselves. All sorts of things. In a workplace, they'll ask people for their opinion of their work and for their performance, instead of just sort of letting it slide and not even really thinking about it. And a child, it often looks the same. So let's move on to a search for this. Again, if you haven't read this already, go ahead and hit pause now. Okay, assertiveness. If you think of assertiveness, what comes to mind often are people like Gandhi and Mother Teresa. These people were incredibly emotionally intelligent. They were able to assert themselves in a non-aggressive manner. Also, being assertive is, if you have a problem with somebody, you'll confront them. So you won't go on and just leave it at, you know, just being there, leaving it out in the sort of just not addressing it, hoping it'll go away. You got a problem, you confront them. There was a movie, I don't know if anyone saw, Aaron Brockovich, about the water fiasco, etc. Great example in that movie, where there was this guy who was revving up his motorcycle, and it wasn't so late at night, but late enough. Aaron Brockovich comes home, she's angry, she's upset, and she's trying to get her kids in bed, and she runs out, and she starts screaming at this guy, "What are you thinking? Get that, turn that thing off, etc. How inconsiderate are you, etc." And the guy gets up, and he's like, "Oh, okay, well, I'm very sorry," and he tries to deal with it in a non-aggressive manner, and Aaron Brockovich just keeps throwing insult after insult and sarcasm, and giving him just lip, and just giving him a really hard time. And instead of reacting to that, he sort of is, you know, very passive, and he just takes it, and he addresses the core issue. He doesn't address what she's saying to him. He addresses the underlying issue, and he tries to keep it on track instead of digressing on all these assaults that she's offering him. A great example of kind of an assertive, emotionally intelligent person. On a child, this person might be able to confront the teacher, their parent, or other children when it's necessary. A bully is not an example of an emotionally intelligent person because they're not doing it in a non-destructive manner. So now let's go on to the next slide. Continue with the interpersonal domain and self-regard. So again, hit pause and read these two definitions. Okay, self-regard. This is basically another way of saying self-esteem and self-confidence. EQ people have kind of combined these things into the same. For an adult, their opinion of themselves is lower than their potential. So I know this person who is really great with children. Fantastic. She's a nanny. Great job. Yet, this person said to me one day, "You know, I don't really think I'd be a good parent." And this was just a shocker to me. She would make a fantastic parent. She said, "Well, I have a temper, and I don't think it would work well enough. I've known this person for almost a year. I can't see that at all. She really just has a low self-regard." Many, many other things along this line. Again, it's where your opinion of yourself is lower than your potential. For a child, this child with a low self-regard might not take on new goals, or they'll give up quickly. Let's move on to self-actualization. For an adult, it's someone who is just going to work, they're just going through the motions, they're working for the weekend, they've, you know, 5 days out of every week are kind of lost. For a child, they just do the schoolwork with methodical effort. They aren't really into it, they don't see the point, they don't see the goal, they don't see it as helping them personally, they don't see it as helping them in their future, or if they do, you know, they don't really care, they don't really have something to shoot for, so they just kind of go along, do it methodically, that sort of thing. Future sense of self and hope are often involved here, which we'll talk about more in a minute. So let's go on to the next slide. The last interpersonal one is independence. So again, read this and the empathy one, and then we'll continue. Okay, for independence. An independent adult might be someone who ventures to a new city, who travels through Europe and stays in the hostels, or who starts a dot-com business. For a child, there's a whole bunch of sort of work called attachment theory, and secure attachment or children who are independent. Without getting into all that, a child who is independent is one who might try something first before seeking help. If they're in a library, they won't always ask the librarian or someone to get the book for them. They'll try themselves. They'll start the lemonade stand. They'll sell Girl Scout cookies. Now, teens are often very independent, but they lack wisdom. And wisdom is really kind of a conglomeration of many of these emotional intelligences. In fact, I'll throw in real quick that wisdom or maturity is, as we all think, something that improves with age. And in fact, when you measure the emotional intelligence of people across the age range, it does get better over age. People do get wiser and more mature. Okay, empathy. Empathy is certainly, I think, a cornerstone of emotional intelligence. In fact, if I had to pick one that was absolutely the most essential, I'd pick empathy. I was once watching this show on television, and they had this psychologist talking about why people cheat in marriages. Anyway, it was just one little side comment that really struck at empathy. And he was saying, you know, empathetic people tend not to do this. Because if they were really empathetic, they'd be there in that situation, in bed with the other man or woman, and about to commit the act of adultery, about to have sex. And if they were to just think, at that moment, you know, I wonder how this is going to make my mate feel. I wonder how my spouse would feel if he or she were standing right here looking at this now. That would be empathy. And again, empathy kind of has to go out the window if you're cheating in marriage. Biting sarcasm is another example. People who use that are not empathetic in general. A counselor who's able to pick out the sulking child. They can see that child. They're able to notice them. They're able to say, okay, well, this is the situation going on, and here's a great way to dealing with it without embarrassing the child and kind of addressing it. Being passive-aggressive is not responding or using empathy. Responding to the core issue is a key component. So when people are passive-aggressive, they're sort of trying to communicate to you in, you know, sort of a negative manner. And someone who's empathetic will not respond to the fact of, you know, you're leaving the dirty dishes in the sink. It's not about leaving the dirty dishes in the sink. It's about time or respect or something else. People who are empathetic can kind of sense that. It's not about the clothes on the floor. It's not about being late. You know, these aren't the core issues involved here. For a child, a bully is someone who's not empathetic. If you like a movie example, the boy in E.T. was very empathetic. There's another child who I knew who, at the end of the day, he would always ask the teacher how she was doing. And during the day, the child would always try and notice. And if the teacher really wasn't doing that good, the child would make a special effort to, after the child got his bike and was riding home for the day, to stop at that teacher's classroom and say, I really hope you have a nice rest of the day. And if the teacher was really not having a good day at all, the child might bring something like, you know, an apple or something like that the next day. Now that's an example of an empathetic child. Let's continue with the interpersonal on slide 15. So there's two examples here. Our two domains that we're going to talk about are subdomains. Interpersonal relationship and social responsibility. So again, hit pause, read these over. When you're ready to continue, hit play. Okay, for interpersonal relationship, an adult, this is someone who has the long-time friends. people comment how nice and warm this person is. I once knew this director who was so gifted in interpersonal relationship skills that people just wanted to be around him. So much so that at the end of camp, even after everyone had their paycheck and everyone was, you know, fine to leave, etc., there was a line of people. 3 hours long it took some of these people to see this director. Just because they wanted to say goodbye, and they wanted to just spend a few more moments with him. He had this enormous gift of interpersonal relationship. For a child is someone who has healthy friendships. They're not neglected or rejected in their peer groups, and they know how to give compliments. This is extremely important because children who are rejected, neglected is bad, but it's not so bad. Children who are rejected from their peer groups tend to have enormous problems in their life. In fact, some developmental psychologists have said, if you can tell me one thing about a child, tell me if they've been rejected from a peer group or not. It's that important. So, interpersonal relationship skills for a child, absolutely crucial. Social responsibility. For an adult, this is someone who volunteers, someone who votes, they don't discriminate, they recycle. There's this little internet thing out now called Napster. It's basically the ability to go out and take free music. You name it, just came out, new song, you want it, it's free. And there is sort of this legal battle going on, etc., but so far it's free and it's legal, sort of. Anyway, folks who use that, which is now numbers in the several millions, with something like in the neighborhood of 100,000 people every day joining, or every week joining this service for free, these people are, you know, lack, in the strictest sense, social responsibility. For a child, this is someone who does the house and the cabin chores, who picks up the litter, doesn't cheat, volunteers, these sorts of things. So let's go on now to adaptability, slide 16. Problem solving and reality testing. So again, take a moment and read these, and when you're ready, continue, hit play again. So problem solving. This is the ability to deal with conflict, to manage one's career. So there's lots of levels with it. Sort of the interpersonal level, sort of the larger sort of career level, managing that aspect of it. Taking a proactive approach to problems, and working smart. So to give you an example, this is the one component that has some degree of relationship to IQ, but it's a low one. To give you an example of this, there was this world-famous chess champion called Kasparov, and he was competing against Deep Blue, which was IBM's massive chess computing machine. Now, Kasparov ended up losing a couple of matches to Deep Blue. And later, several months later, after he had gone through this and reflected on the experience, he said in the end, what got him was his emotions. It wasn't that he couldn't beat Deep Blue. It's that he got flustered. He got stressed. And under those conditions, he wasn't able to perform to his best. A child is one who gets into fights. So when you see children get into fights, which is, you know, sometimes fairly often, they really have a lack of an ability to solve the problem they're having in a way other than a confrontational manner. Another example is, when the going gets tough, the child gives up. Whether it be school or a new activity, they don't think about solving the problem, they just surrender. Reality testing. If anyone watches the show Ally McBeal, perfect example of a whole bunch of people who lack serious ability to test reality. Superstition, voodoo, ESP, horoscopes, all of these things are examples, or taking off the blinders. There's one cute study where they had one of the world's foremost experts in doing horoscopes and reading all this sort of thing do this mass murderer's chart. So she did all this information, well-respected person within that community, and they took that chart, and detailed as it was, and gave it to thousands of college students. And they asked them to rate. They said to these college students, this was done for you. And they asked them to rate how accurate it was, scale of 1 to 10. By and large, most people said it was a 7. Pretty accurate. Again, remember, this was the horoscope done for a mass murderer, and all these college students, on average, thought it was fairly accurate of them. For a child. A child is a daydreamer. They have really unrealistic expectations about their future or their current abilities. Would be examples of reality testing. Okay, last one on this is flexibility, slide 17. Again, take a moment to read this. Here is an adult, for an example, who doesn't want to hear it. They know it already. They won't entertain another point of view. They're stuck in tradition. It's either their way or the highway. An adult who is flexible will accept that they are mistaken. Now, flexibility and reality testing are somewhat related, but it's really an important quality in camps as well. For folks who have always done it the same way and think they're doing it best, it's important to have that flexibility to think, well, maybe I'm not the best in America or in the world in doing this. And maybe I really should go out and learn how other people are doing things better. For a child, it tends to be rare that children are inflexible. It does tend to be more common in teenagers, though. For a child, it tends to be more manifest in one who is set in their ruts. Okay, let's move on to slide 18 here, and stress management. So we have here stress tolerance and impulse control. So again, take a moment, read these over, and hit play when you're ready. Stress tolerance. An adult is someone who is crippled or paralyzed when substantial problems arise. They can't deal with stress, so they leave the scene, either physically or emotionally. They flip out, they freeze, they lash out, it's road rage, this kind of thing. For a child, I'll give you a couple of examples. There was once a child who was on a 3-day hike, going along the Appalachian Trail, and the child just sat down. The child couldn't handle it anymore, couldn't problem solve the situation, couldn't deal, just sat down and gave up. Another example is facing bears. A bunch of children have bear, lots of experience, lots of bears around kind of thing. And the children, after they had a couple of bear experiences and learned how to deal with it, get together, clap, this kind of thing, and it worked. The child who still flips out completely, or perhaps does even something more dangerous and runs from the bear, is a child who doesn't have the stress tolerance ability. Losing sleep is another common symptom. Impulse control. For an adult, there's lots of research and information that's been going around about what we can do about people who are at high risk for HIV. Well, one idea was to sort of just give them lots of information and education. But these people, by and large, already know how HIV is transmitted. And there's kind of a little saying with this in this community, and that is, when the music's sweet and the lights are low, it all goes out the window. It all comes down to impulse control. Lots of other examples. Eating the wrong foods. You know what a good diet is, you need to be able to do it. Procrastinating. Waiting for a desirable item. When you're faced with the option, not getting the more expensive item when you really shouldn't. Impulse control can be sort of likened to a muscle. It's built up over time through exercise. You have to exercise the ability to delay gratification in order to build that capacity up. For children, there was this famous study called the Marshmallow Study. Time Magazine did it. Lots of problems with this in all sorts of ways, but for a quick illustrative example, I'll use it. The Marshmallow Study was basically a university lab study, and what they would do is they'd take children of all ages, but let's say 8 years old, and they'd say, okay, here's a little room and a little table, just sit here, and here's a marshmallow. Now, if you can wait, I'm going to go away, and in a little while, they didn't say how long, I'm going to come back. And if you haven't eaten this marshmallow, I'll give you 2 marshmallows. So what this child was faced with was delay in gratification, some impulse control. Turns out that the children who were able to delay gratification and control their impulses did much better in all sorts of ways later in life. They had better grades, they had happier marriages, they went on to higher education more frequently, all sorts of things, more friends, lots of things. Other examples for children: overeating, strong emotions and fighting, not being able to control those, all those fall in the range of impulse control. So let's go on to the last one here now. Slide 19, general mood, happiness and optimism. Again, take a moment, hit play when you're ready. Okay, happiness. First, I have to say that virtually all of these emotional intelligences do have a genetic component. They've done lots of studies along the lines of twins, and for happiness, for example, it tends to be about 50-50. About 50% is genetic and 50% is environment. Now, these vary for all these things, for all of these, but it's important to keep in mind that there is a genetic component. Some people are just happier than others by design. But, you know, there's lots of wiggle room on either side of wherever somebody is. What tends to make people happy is they need to have social support and friends. We're definitely social animals. So, things that lead to that would be interpersonal relationship skills, empathy, independence, problem-solving ability, assertiveness, self-regard, just to name a few. Those things are extremely important in being able to create a close, supportive group of friends. Friends, vital to happiness. Someone who enjoys their work. Someone who needs to be moderately self-actualized. It also involves the ability learning how to play and having leisure skills and desires. And camp can certainly influence this as well. In fact, in many ways, especially with children not playing so much in their normal lives as they used to, camp can be a great education in having children learn how to play and to give them those leisure skills and desires. For optimism, it can basically be likened to seeing the glass as half full or half empty. And optimistic people see it as half full. It all comes down to attribution. You gotta figure that when something bad happens, optimistic people say, okay, it wasn't my fault. It was the fault of the situation. Or, okay, I screwed up this time, but I don't usually screw up. Or, yeah, I just wasn't really trying. If I try harder, I can do it. These are the thoughts of optimistic people. If you read the book Don't Sweat the Small Stuff, a lot of that is kind of training in optimism. And there is a book about training optimistic children as well, which is referenced in the end. Having a future sense of self is something optimistic people tend to have. They tend to see themselves doing well in the future. And indeed, future sense of self is a crucial thing for children to have. For example, gang members tend to have higher self-esteem than the general population. So do prisoners. Higher self-esteem than the general population. However, when you take into account future sense of self, the ability to have a beneficial and positive future, gang members and prisoners are scored way lower than the general population. So part of this is attitude and part of it is reality. Kind of what will your future look like? Okay, let's go on to slide 20, and you can just see, let's do a little recap here of where we are. Gone through sort of the introduction, we've talked about emotional intelligence in some detail, so you kind of get a good idea for it. We've just skimmed over the top here, but I hope you kind of understand all of this, and if you want more information, you can use some of the books in the end. So now we're on point 3, and we're going to be talking about emotionally intelligent parenting. So slide 21. there's four parenting or slash counseling styles. Diana Baumrind is somebody as a researcher who's really looked a lot into the whole parenting style kind of thing. And she's come up with four basic sort of topologies or domains. Authoritarian parent, an uninvolved parent, a permissive parent, and authoritative parent. We're really not going to go into that, but for people who are into that kind of framework, or if you've looked at the developmental textbooks or social or taken parenting classes, whatever, that kind of tends to be the breakdown. In EQ language, you can have a dismissing parent, disapproving parent, laissez-faire, or emotion coaching parent. And those are the four we're going to go over here. If you want more information about the other parenting styles, please look in the behavior management plan file that's on the CD, and that'll give you more information about it at the end. Little note at the bottom, wearing many hats. People are definitely not one style all the time. Lots of reasons why people would change their styles. For example, the situation at one point might demand kind of a more authoritarian style. Yet the default style for a parent might be authoritative. Likewise, at some point, people might be primarily authoritarian, but use the authoritative style, vice versa. So, it's not that anyone's one particular style. It's just the point I'm trying to make. And if you take the little assessment that's in the file on the EQ handout, you'll see that's the case. So, the dismissing parent. So, as you can see, here's a list of characteristics. So, again, take a moment, read these over real quick. Okay, so as you can see, as someone who just doesn't really want to deal with the child's emotion, they just want to get it over with quickly as possible. Examples of this, I'm just going to go ahead and go through these with you. When a pet dies, it's, oh, don't worry, you'll get a new one. And he was old, it was time for him to die. They don't want to confront or talk about the child's sadness, and perhaps fear of the child's own death or their parents' death. The child needs to feel both understood and comforted here. When Jimmy is sad, it makes me sad, because you want to think that your kids are happy and well-adjusted. I don't want to see him upset. I want him to be happy all the time. Wants the child's negative emotions to disappear quickly. Did he do that to you? Oh, don't worry, honey. Why don't you go out into the garden, pick and prune some roses? I'll make you some of my lemonade. This kind of thing. In fact, I knew one person who had this kind of parent. And at 13 years old, she literally had to be committed to a mental hospital because she ripped all of her hair out and was just having a nervous breakdown. She couldn't deal with her emotions. And as this person, as an adult, doesn't have the greatest life necessarily either. You know, he's had the divorce, he's had several other unsuccessful relationships. The inability to deal with emotions has just caused an enormous amount of problems in her life. Effects of this style on children. They learn their feelings are wrong or inappropriate. There's something wrong with them. And they have difficulty regulating their own emotions and getting in touch with their own emotions and appreciating what that means. Again, all sorts of problems related to this kind of thing. The disapproving parent. Okay, take a moment here again and look these over. If you watch the movie American Beauty, a clearly ultra example of this would be the father of the teenager with the video camera. He was ultra-disapproving, ultra-authoritarian. They think emotions are a bad thing. They want to get rid of them. They think you're weak. It's a waste of time. Why are you doing this? And they might punish their children to sort of teach them lessons along these lines. A couple of examples here. I tell Charlie to save his sadness for major things like dead dogs. Losing a toy or tearing a page in a book isn't something you should waste your time being sad on. But the death of a pet Now that's something worth getting sad over. Second example, if Cameron starts yelling, I just say, I won't put up with that. Then, if he continues to act that way, he gets a spanking. Effects, kind of same for the dismissing style. They learn that there's a lot of risk in being emotional, and that if you have bad feelings or feelings, it's your problem, you're the fly in the ointment, you're the embarrassment. Get over it. Laissez-faire parent, free and easy, quickly read these over. They tend not to offer much guidance. They don't really teach the child about the emotions or problem-solving method, which is the key thing here. They just kind of let the child go about figuring things out for themselves. They don't try and say, well, here's the emotion you're having. Let's talk about this. Let's try and work this through. Let's think about it. Let's think of another way to solve this problem. They just kind of think that it's all a matter of hydraulics. Just let it go, and the work is done. Examples here, say there's a crying child. There, there, honey. It's okay. Just let it all out. Everything will be just fine. Later, the child eventually stops. Okay, honey, let's go into the kitchen and make some brownies. Let's say Jane, next example, won't come in for dinner when called. So the husband says to the wife, Jane's playing in the yard again. I told her dinner was ready, but she won't come in. Let's just go ahead and eat, and she'll come in when she's hungry. Again, the child just gets to go about doing their own kind of way. Effects are really, they don't learn how to regulate their own emotions because they've never had that practice. They have trouble getting along with people for that same reason. They don't know how to regulate their own emotions. They don't know how to get along with people well. Trouble concentrating and dealing with other people's inability in their own way. And they often lack the ability to calm themselves. So let's go over the last style here, the emotion coaching parent. So take a moment and read the characteristics. Okay, so let's go over some of the examples. 9 out of 10 times, she doesn't really know where her feelings are coming from. So I try and help her identify her feelings, and then we talk about what to do next time, how to handle this or that. Second example, I want my child to know that just because they're angry doesn't mean they're bad or they necessarily hate the person they're angry with. I want them to know that good things can happen from the things that make them angry. Third example, 10 years down the road, I hope Jennifer will have dealt with these feelings enough times that she'll know how to react. I hope she'll have the self-confidence to know it's okay to feel this way, and there's something she can do about it. Again, more the problem-solving approach. Effects this style, they learn to trust their feelings, regulate their emotions, and solve problems. They have higher emotional self-awareness, better assertiveness, empathy, interpersonal relationship skills, flexibility, impulse control, and self-regard. And an indirect influence on social responsibility because it does require empathy. So, if you're looking for ways to improve emotional intelligence, the emotion coaching style has a direct influence pretty much on all of these I just mentioned. Very effective. The emotion coaching process in general is as listed here. First, become aware of the child's emotion. Understand that they're having one. That when the child steals a ball from someone else, that they're angry or they're embarrassed or they're frustrated or whatever is going on. Recognize the emotion as an opportunity for intimacy and teaching. So it's not something to get angry about. It's something, okay, here's something where, you know, Johnny or Jane needs to learn something here. 3 is when you actually start talking instead of just thinking. That is to listen empathetically and validate the child's feelings. Understand, okay, what was going on here? Tell me what you were feeling. Tell me what you were doing. This kind of thing. Definitely focusing on the feeling aspect at this point. And you help the child find words to label the emotion. So again, this should be done in kind of a Socratic process. Socratic means asking questions as opposed to telling. And 5th, set limits while exploring strategies to solve the problem at hand. So this can really be broken out into other steps. So that, after step 5, the problem solving, 1, you want to find out the goal of the behavior. And so in this you could say, you know, what did you want? Help the child verbalize or discuss the actions taken towards a goal. You know, well, what did you do to get it? Assess the effectiveness from all the angles of the behaviors. Okay, well, how did that work? Again, here it's key to think, how did it work? I mean, if you're talking to them about this, it obviously was ineffective in some way or another, so you need to help them come to that conclusion themselves, as opposed to just telling them. It makes all the difference in the world to do this Socratically. You also want them to be thinking about how it made other people feel. Identifying others' feelings is a key way to foster empathy. Examine the full range of possible behavior attitude options. So what were or are all the options here? So this is what you did. Let's brainstorm. Let's think of other ways this could have been done. Then pick the best one. And then check back to see how it works. Once that's been all going on, you say, okay, look, that's the plan. That's what you'll do next time. Let's just check back in a couple days and see how that's working for you. The problem-solving process impacts problem-solving. Interpersonal relationships, reality testing, stress tolerance, that's the focus, and impulse control. So several other domains of emotional intelligence influence there. So if you're looking to influence emotional intelligence, again, very sparse, but nonetheless, this kind of general process influences a number of them. Okay, now let's finish up, or continue here briefly in the end, talking about some general EQ building principles. In essence, knowledge alone of these is a necessary but insufficient condition. Knowing what EQ is doesn't mean you'll be emotionally intelligent. If it were, all we'd have to do is define this for people, and the world would be a better place. Frequently, knowledge does not translate into behavior. Just think of all the things where this is the case. Eating well, safe sex, exercise, drugs, seatbelts, stress control, parenting skills, speeding. In many cases, we know what is right, and yet we don't actually carry that through to action. Behavior change. Life is the classroom. It is practice, practice, practice that makes for behavior change. And in general, it takes months and not days to build emotional intelligence. Can be done in a shorter period of time, especially in the camp environment. It's helpful if it's continued outside the camp environment, and they're not the only ones trying to do it. But in general, life is the way to learn. It is practice. It is living. Camp is good at this, I think, because the majority of camp is social interaction, with mentors there right on hand. Do-it-yourself EQ surgery is not the most effective or painless method here. You need to have a mentor scaffold with you. A scaffold is someone who kind of helps you through it, but they don't just, they're not, kind of doing it for you. They just help you as much as almost as necessary, but as little as possible. Modeling so they can watch people do this well, and feedback in general lies at the heart of change. It is through feedback that people understand what they're doing and able to take that into account. General EQ building activities, though, things like meditation, journal writing, prayer, and emotion log, talked about more in the EQ handout. Without motivation, there's no mobilization. People have to have the reason to change in the first place. There's kind of four levels here. Oblivious, what problem, not a problem, get out of my face. Contemplation, okay, maybe, okay, I'll think about this. Preparation is, okay, I'm going to do this. Let's think about how I'm going to do it. And then the last step is they actually do implement their plan and they start changing their behavior. The only way really to encourage motivation is people have to understand that this is going to help them. It fits their values, their hopes, their goals, and their dreams. It fits their resources and their interests. That is where the level of change and the basis and focus and desire for change need to come from. Okay, slide 40. Ask almost anyone and they'll tell you they're emotionally intelligent. So, you know, some people are, you know, self-deprecating or modest or whatever, but in general, if you really ask people candidly, most people will probably tell you, unless they have a low self-regard perhaps, that they're probably decently, at least average, emotionally intelligent. But EQ is very much like IQ. You know, not everybody is average. Although 100 is the average, people fall on either side of this, and it's normally distributed, just like IQ. So, it's important to measure EQ. You can see the next two slides here are kind of a list of things. The multi-factor emotional intelligence scale. This is kind of this four-branch way of looking at emotional intelligence. That's one way to go about it. The Mayer Salovey Caruso Emotional Intelligence Test, available in midsummer 2000. It's called the Mesquite. This is really an ability version of EQ, very much in the classical IQ domain of things. The last one is an online test, unproven, but it's the only one on the internet, and take it in for interest, FYI. But do recognize that the results may have nothing to do with your real EQ. There's some 360-degree evaluation versions noted on the top here for sort of helping people develop in an organizational, interpersonal setting. Daniel Goleman did another one, the Work Profile Questionnaire. Those are okay. They tend to be really expensive to use. He's got this whole little consulting business, little gig going on around that. The one that's really good, most people tend to use, and the one I personally like the best, is the Baran Emotional Intelligence Scale. I like it because they have lots of versions. They've got the 360-degree version. They've got an interview version if you want to interview staff and think about how to use EQ in terms of hiring people in that way. They have an adult version, and they have a youth version. So I really like that version quite a bit. Unfortunately, if you hire a professional to assess EQ for you, you can expect to pay $100 to $150 a shot, sometimes as much as $200 a shot. If you have someone who's certified, master's or PhD level psychologist or education, or someone who has a lot of experience in testing, you can expect to pay anywhere from $20 to $40 per assessment. And so it does tend to be kind of expensive. Sometimes you can get breaks on this one way or another. But they won't give the scale to anybody. You have to definitely send proof that you are qualified and certified and capable. Useful websites. If you want to try the internet approach to learning more about EQ, these are some of the most useful ones I've found. It's a pretty comprehensive list because there really isn't that much on the internet out there. Important related books. Again, a list of books that you can use if you want to go about learning more about emotional intelligence. These are some of the major players here. And that's the end of the presentation. Normally I'd ask for questions and discussion now, but since this is kind of a one-sided way, if you do have any questions or you'd like to discuss something, please feel free to contact me. My information is available on the website noted there. And you can email me or give me a ring or write me a letter or whatever you like. I hope you enjoyed this, and I hope you learned quite a bit. And to revisit the beginning, emotional intelligence is absolutely crucial. And I think that our society needs it. We have a definite deficit, and it's getting worse over time. On the camp environment side of things, 95%, I think, of all non-structural problems can be related or traced to deficiency in one or more of the EQ domains. Thank you.